Today, I want to talk about spirit writing in Sichuan, or the anxiety for the future. The reason why I changed the topic a little bit is that I realized that, as most of us realize, the audience is heterogeneous. So some of you know a lot about spirit writing, some of you know nothing about spirit writing. And so it's I hope that I'll give you an introduction and then possibly going in depth into my topic of research, which is spirit writing communities in Sichuan. So I want to start by saying, what is spirit writing? Spirit writing is a religious technique that connects a person, or more often a community, gathered around an altar to a specific divinity in an effort to respond to personal requests, to seek positive outcomes, and for general moral guidance. The divinity then responds by dictating scriptures through the body of a medium and through an implement that I will show you in a second. The practice is part of a larger context of divine revelations which have a long history in Chinese religions, especially Taoism. This specific practice has an attested beginning in the 11th or 12th century, but it flourished later and developed in very specific ways in the late imperial and republican period. Seeking a personal connection with the divine word in the form of written communication is a long-standing Chinese religious practice, and the work of Taoist scholars on the formation of early Taoist scriptures through divine revelations are an excellent example of that. But this mode of communication is also one that China shares with many other religions and cultures, and a cross-cultural comparison is something that is definitely needed in the future. However, while Western instantiations of the practice have received much attention and research, religious text revelation in China has received not as much attention as it should have. More specifically, while the early formation of Taoist canons through revelatory practices has been studied in detail, this practice, ubiquitous in the late Qing and the Republican period and present in Taiwan and Hong Kong until today, needs more work, especially from a historical point of view. So, more specifically, I want to say really quickly how this works. A medium visited by the divinity holds a bifurcated tree branch on the top of a sand tray. The branch is moved by the divinity and forms words on the tray. The words are then read out loud by an attendant and written down by at least one other attendant. Sometimes specific questions are posed, sometimes the divinity responds to contemporary events inside or outside the community, and the short responses or longer scriptures are then distributed, printed, and distributed to the individuals or the whole community. This is still what happens today in Taiwan and in Hong Kong. And we have very long scriptures from the Qing Dynasty, which were transmitted in this way and which are the topic of my work. Now, what is spirit writing? It's originally, I wanted to just give you a really brief sense of the origin. Some scholars say that the origins are in the cult of Zigu, the goddess of the latrines. Zigu was apparently a concubine who was of a wealthy man who was shunned by the primary wife of that wealthy man and eventually killed in the latrine. And then her figure became a goddess and became the goddess to which women would resort to when they wanted to know the fate, for example, of their silkworm harvest. So in one of the instantiations of this practice of asking Zigu about the silkworm harvest, there is the use of a basket wielded by two people with an attached stick connected to a tray filled with ashes. And this is what it looks like still today in some communities. It is used. There's a basket and then there's a stick. And in a Song Dynasty manual, this is how it is explained. Prepare a small woven basket and insert a single chopstick through the apex. Fill a purified vessel with approximately 2 liters, two liners of purified ashes. Set up a presentation tablet. Day and night attend to fumigation, making sure to be truly immaculate. If there's a prayer, spread the ashes on the surface of the table, bring the basket close by, A master evocator takes up the procedure. After burning a talisman, order a superb innocent to stand in the position of the guest. Next, the master evocator takes his stance as a host, and then, empty-handed, each takes hold of the basket. They stand flanking the table, letting the chopstick poke into the ashes. The basket moves when a transcendent arrives. So therefore, the basket moves, these two people hold it, and the basket moves when the god or goddess arrives and writes in the ashes. These are some images of how women might have gone about this practice. And then we have also more contemporary images of how it is done today. I also have, so this is, so that was the basket. Nowadays, the basket is not used very much anymore, but this bifurcated tree branch is used. Two people still hold it, and the divinity descends and writes on the sand, and each, they write one character at a time, and then this character is said out loud and then written down. I do have a couple of videos for you. So this is how it works. The character is written in the sand. The assistant clears the sand, and then in the next video, if I can get back to the presentation. Yeah, in the next video we see the this is still the writing in the sand, and then we see the assistant, we see the people who say out loud the words that are written, the gods, and then the person who writes down what is said. So that's, I also have, this is in Taiwan, this is an altar in Taiwan. Here I have, and that was not taken by me, it's a part of a website where the altar itself shows the spirit writing process. Here is something that I videoed in Hong Kong. Let's see if I can press it. And here you see a slightly different, and here you might know some people. Daniel Burton Rose is right here, and you will see him in a minute. There he is. So this is just a one person using a similar stick, a similar implement, but just one person and one other person who writes down the message from the god. So this is also possible, just having one person. It's simpler instead of having four or five people do this. So this is a long video, and she wrote a long scripture. So here, let's go back to here. Okay, so then you get a sense of what we're talking about when we're talking about spirit writing. And this is exactly her early observation in Taiwan also have this. There's a chief a wielder of the phoenix. This implement is also called the phoenix, the assistant phoenix wielder, the altar manager, the announcer, and the scribe. So this has been has been transmitted in this way for centuries. And it's definitely the practice that was used to produce several of the, for example, of the text that I have worked with. Now, here I have very quickly just a terminology for all of you who want to know a little bit more about it. There are different terms. There are the groups that and the spaces where the spirit writing is performed are called Phoenix Hall. Phoenix Hall, Professor Clark, who's here in the back, says Fuluan, which is the descending of the phoenix, involves people supporting the writing implement while writing in the sand, but also there's a possibility that the implement is not held, not supported by a human, and directly moved by the divinity, so automatic writing. There are another couple of possibilities which recently scholars have discussed. Bilu, which is implemented by a single person, visited by the divinity, writing with a brush rather than with that implement. And then also, this is a slightly different practice in Sichuan also using a brush. So there's different ways to write down the words of the divinity. This technique in the late Ming and Qing dynasties, so in the late imperial period, more or less 1500, 1600, 1700 and onwards, was appropriated by literati. There was an explosion of spirit writing communities and corpuses from the 17th century onwards, and generally lay Taoist communities were responsible for it, not connected to a Taoist temple, but to an altar to a specific god. These gods are the more common divinities. There are many more divinities, but the more common divinities are Wenchang, Ludongbing, Guanti, and Zhenwu, sometimes Jiang Sanfeng. But these are the most common divinities for which we have now corpuses all received through spirit writing. The Luzi Chuanshu, the Wendi Chuanshu, the Guanti Chuanshu, the Jiang Sanfeng Chuanji. So we see a rise in these corpuses, the rise, it says there, the progressive canonization of corpuses of revelations is intimately linked to the promotion of cults, which gradually rise between the 12th and century and the late Qing, from obscure local cults to universal and official cults. This is the writing by Vincent Gossard. The gods themselves are canonized by the emperor in the period between 1800 and 1805. So what are some of the reasons for using spirit writing? Different communities use it differently, and different scholars, I'm collating here words from ideas from scholars who have studied both spirit writing contemporary times or in historical times. Literati worrying about the past passing the imperial examination, so they would ask, you know, will I pass the imperial examination? And the divinity would respond negatively or positively. Also, there is a practice of the elites for entertainment, solving personal problems, finding cures, divining personal fate, exchanging poems, exchanging questions. Also, as a desire to deify the most prominent members of the community, who, when they died, they would then connect with their community and say, hey, I'm up here, I can connect with you, we can have a conversation. As a response to intense anxiety in relation to uncertain chaotic times, with a focus on saving humanity from disaster. This is something that Vincent Gossard has talked about when he was here in December, the eschatological part of spirit writing, the element, the eschatological element of spirit writing. Also, as a desire to assert the community's importance within a new locality, which is what I will be talking about a little bit in terms of Sichuan, in the context of dissemination of Confucian morality, in the Republican period, more in relation to practice of philanthropy and self-cultivation, and also in contemporary Taiwan as a reaffirmation of Confucian moral values and virtues in a period of decline. So different ways, different reasons for connecting with the gods. Some of these collections are then part of a Taoist collection. So these are not necessarily Taoist collections, but some of those texts make it into Taoist collections. This is the Dao Zanji Yao, which has part of it, of this large collection of Taoist texts, has text revealed from Du Dongbing, which is one of these gods. Now, I want to take 1 minute to talk a little bit about research challenges in terms, and so moving away from the historical progression, and then I'll go back to it. But here I just wanted to mention how, why this is a recent development, not so recent for ethnography, but certainly for historical discussions and of spirit writing. Why? Because, first of all, these texts, as I will talk about later, fall through the cracks of categories. Sometimes they're Taoist, but they also have Buddhist elements, but there are also strong moral Confucian elements in them. And these practices were deemed superstitious in the Republican and Communist period, so therefore they were criticized. In 1949, religious practices were banned in China, and spirit writing mostly died out in China, but not in Taiwan and Hong Kong. And most foreign scholars, of course, were forbidden from entering China, and local scholars could not research religious practices. After the 1980s, there's been a slow opening of China, both to researchers who want to look at ethnographical materials, but also archives where many of these materials are found. These materials, though, are found scattered in archives, and therefore it's really a puzzle to go to this archive and that archive to see what you find. Sometimes, for example, one of the texts that I'll be talking about later has text remains in the Sichuan provincial archives and nothing else. Practices have died out with the exception of Taiwan and Hong Kong, and research has taken place specifically in Taiwan, Hong Kong, and southern China. And so other parts of China are still lagging behind. That's why my focus on Sichuan. So my sources are woodblock printed collection in Sichuan libraries, stele inscriptions, local gazetteers, and visual evidence from local sites. Areas of inquiries that are interesting, but not all of them will be discussed today, are the vertical transmission between gods and humans. Also, the textual authorship, canon formation and transmission, horizontal transmission of these texts. So that you have a vertical transmission, and then, of course, somebody carves wood blocks and puts them together in canons and then transmits them also for merit making. And this brings to the fore the idea of the relationship between religion and printing, which is a large topic that I won't touch here, but it is obviously interesting for spirit writing. Prognostication, eschatology, and soteriology, again, something that many scholars are interested in. Self-cultivation, which actually is a great part of the canons that we have received. Taoist, Neidan, self-cultivation is a large part of these texts, and that has not been discussed very prominently. And then syncretism, or Sanjiao Hui, or the unity of the three teachings, which is something that I will talk about at the end of the talk today, if I get to it, because it's getting late. So why Sichuan? This is Sichuan. This is a landlocked area of China. It's kind of at the periphery, far from the center and far from the coastal areas where most elite scholars were gathered and where most of the research about spirit writing has been done. So Sichuan is landlocked, is at the periphery, is also very close to Tibetan areas. So it has a different setup from most coastal areas, and that's why I find it interesting. So these are the reasons why I'm interested in Sichuan. So most communities that are studied are on coastal areas, so there's a lack of attention to Sichuan. After the devastation of the Ming-Qing transition in the 17th century, Sichuan's population was decimated, and then emperors actively encouraged migration to Sichuan from other areas. So there was an incredible increase in population from 3 million in 1678 to 22 million in 1813 to 85 million in 1898, obviously greatly modifying the social structure. The majority of these people came from Hunan, Hubei, Jiangxi, and Guangdong. And so there was obviously an influx of new religious practices with these communities coming in. There are also, apart from this great migration, there are also rebellions and wars in Sichuan in this period of time, millenarian rebellion, anti-taxation revolts, and there were definitely imperial efforts to pacify and civilize this area. So these are the reasons why I'm interested in Sichuan. These are the reasons why I think it might be different. We might find different peculiarities about the sources in Sichuan. So this is the movement of people towards Sichuan during the Qing Dynasty. So the massive migration to Sichuan, spirit writing and new textual production happens also in Sichuan, and the canonization of gods, altar building in Sichuan, spread of charitable activities. All of this happens in the Qing Dynasty in Sichuan. I'm going to move to case studies. I was debating whether to give you one case studies, a couple of case studies. I will give you lots of case studies, but probably won't go through them very, very specifically. But I wanted to give you what we have right now about Sichuan. So the first four are things that are communities that I have looked at. The last three are communities that other scholars have looked at, and I wanted to mention them here because not many, as I said before, not many scholars work on Sichuan. So I wanted to sort of give you a sense of what the field is today. And I had a Google map that was interactive, but it's hard to go back and forth from this and to that. So I have a picture of the Google map, which is not interactive. And the reason why I have this is because there is a Wenchang community network at work here. There is a connection here to Confucian Kongjia, Confucian religion, also through spirit writing. And there's also connections between altars. Now, of course, I don't have the names of these because this is not an interactive map, but suffice it to say that what I will be talking about, you can see here, this is one community, this is another community, this is yet another community, but you can see that these communities have connections, and these connections are texts that have been either texts that have been shared between communities, or these communities use the same altars to receive texts. So that's why I put all of this in connection, because there is a great amount of back and forth between these communities, even though they are separate communities. And there's a lot more that is not on this map, and this is just a sample of what we know. So the first community that I have here, I wrote an article about this, but here very quickly I will talk to you about this community, which is a guild hall for merchant from Jiangxi. So I just talked about the fact that Jiangxi was one of the regions where people came to Sichuan from, these merchants had guild halls, had places where they got together, and they did business, but also had religious practices there. So these merchants have an altar in this guild hall to Lu Dongbing, and they receive the Lu Zuhuiji in that altar. This merchant community is not really Taoist. They are connected to various charitable practices, Confucian practices, but they don't see themselves as Taoist, even though Lu Zu is supposed to be, or is traditionally has been, a Taoist god. So received in Chongyang, which is west of Chengdu, and it's, if maybe we can go back, this is where it is, right here, actually. And this is the first page of this text. This is the one that has only one copy in the Sichuan Provincial Library. This is the site of the Jiangxi Huiguan, as it is. It was impossible to go in. I don't know if it's completely... Oh, you don't see anything. Anyways, I'm sorry about that. I see it pretty well on my... This says Jiangxi Huiguan right here, so the guild hall from the Jiangxi. And anyways, so it's a little dark. This is also the area where this is. This is one of the religious, this is a furnace here where paper was burned because it's a Confucian practice where with paper that is that has writing on it shouldn't be disposed or used to go to the toilet, for example, but should actually be honored and burned in this furnace. Here you don't see, but there's a stele. This is a new building that they rebuilt, but it's in the same style as the old building that was there with the same inscription. This is the inscription that they recarved.
And here you see the name of Lu Dongbing, and here you see the name of Wen Chang.
What is in this book? It is actually Lu Dongbing came down to a community in on the coastal area to and there that text was called the Luzu Chuanshu. And here he came back again to this particular area, to this particular community, and transmit some of the same and some other new texts. The interesting thing here is that immediately this community says that Confucius and Mencius are above Lu Dongbing. So what was transmitted, what Lu Dongbing received from above was transmitted from Confucius and Mencius. So therefore, Confucius and Mencius are really the people who are transmitting this down. So strong Confucian elements, also in all the prefaces, preeminence given to moral instruction. They're also Taoist self-cultivation texts, but are all relegated to an appendix. So there's a clear shift of priorities from previous collections. And this shows, I contend, the merchant's desire to assert their presence in a new locality. Why is this unique? Because the social and religious context is different from previous ones outside of Sichuan, which were mostly connected to Taoist altars. The Luzu Huiji is not received at a Taoist altar, but at a merchant guild hall. The publication happens in a charitable hall. It's supported financially by merchants, and they are more Confucius than Taoist. So redirecting a Taoist practice toward moralistic and philanthropic aims. This is one of my, we do still have some time. The second case studies is Fu Jinquan, who was also from Jiangxi and moved to Sichuan in 1817, where he proceeded to receive and publish several texts collected together in the Daoshu Shiqizhong at a local publishing house, which has an interesting history. Now, some examples, there's many, many texts, but these are some examples. And you can see that there's a Meijing Dan, which is sort of self-cultivation book. There's the scripture of the letter to salvation, so there's salvationist text. There's Luzu right here. And Kunming Miao Jing, the presence of a text specifically for women. Actually, spirit-written texts, often have sections on women, on female meditation techniques. And these texts have large parts on the moral behavior of women, specifically for women. So this is definitely something that needs to be looked into. Tomorrow morning, for those of you who will be at the text reading, we'll be looking at one of these texts for women. Just wanted to mention the gender element, because many of these texts have sections for women. Main themes here too: Confucian virtues, unity of Taoism and Buddhism, self-cultivation, and the salvation of humankind. The next a group of people is a group of people around Li Xiyue, who was a local Taoist on Leshan. So he was not a merchant, he was not an immigrant. He also received several, he put together scriptures from Lu Dongbing and from Zhang Sanfeng, as well as healing manuals, as well as scriptures with Buddhist elements. These are some of these texts also from the Sichuan Provincial Library. And you see there's a pocket version, there's a larger version. So if you have a pocket version, you can take it around and read it, while you're on the road. This is a healing manual that has interesting characters that are talismans that are used to heal people. So each of these talismans has a particular healing power. There's also, as I said, Buddhist elements. There's Sanskrit, or I believe it's Sanskrit. So all of these elements are there. So I'm going to go a little quickly. I just wanted to give you sort of a bird's eye view. And then we get to a temple. This is a visual example of what I've been trying to talk about, which is sort of the coming together of elements of Buddhism, of Taoism, specifically Taoism and Confucianism, and sometimes, to a lesser extent, Buddhism. This is a temple that I visited, the Chunyangguan, which is dedicated to Ludongbing, who is also whose name is also Chunyang, it's in Xinjiang, south of Chengdu. It was started to be built in 1795, but then rebuilt again at the beginning of the 20th century. And in the Republican period, became the place for a philanthropic organization. The main architectural themes that you will see in a second are that there's halls and statues for all gods, Buddhist, Taoist, and Confucian. So there's Zhang Sanfeng, Lu Dongbing, Wen Chang, as well as Confucius and Buddha. But the largest areas are dedicated to two halls for Confucian sages, the Zhixiaoting and the Ta Zhongting, so Hall of Extreme Filiality and Hall of Great Loyalty. And I'll show you where. So this is the entrance. These are the steles that tell us that this was started to build in the Guangxu period. In here in 1795. Actually, no, that's a different, the Guangxu period is later. But anyway, so this is a stele from, with donors, names of donors, to say who gave money to build the temple. And then these are the various statues that are more modern statues, but likely they were there before there were older statues. So these are also Confucian pronouncements about the Confucian orthodoxy and about the importance of teaching filiality and loyalty. This is the marker that says that this belonged to the Zheshan Tuan that was here in the philanthropic organization. And these are the two big halls for the Confucian worthies. These are all Confucian worthies right there. These are the largest halls of the temple. So again, I wanted to point out that we have spirit writing gods here, but also large halls for Confucian worthies. Other examples in Sichuan have been studied by other scholars, the Lumen community by Volker Oles, the Wenchang network by Hu Jiechen, and the Kongjiao network by Wang Jianchuan. I will not go through these very carefully, but suffice it to say that they also have similar setup of elements of Confucianism together with elements of Taoism. So for example, the Lumen community is a self-described Confucian school, but it actively supported Taoist temples financially, it worshiped Ludongbing, it received scriptures through spirit writing from Ludongbing and Wenchang, but it remained committed to Confucian morality. The Wenchang network has been described by Hu Jiechen as a network that attempted to make Wenchang into the symbol of Confucian teachings. So a combination of Taoist text and Confucian message. And the Kongjia network by Wang Jianchuan has elements of salvationist elements, scriptures that foster Confucian morality, education, and transforming the ignorant, as well as other elements, Taoist and Buddhist elements. Interestingly, they wrote a scripture, Confucian Golden Elixir to Save the World, which is interesting because it puts together Confucianism, salvation, as well as Jindan, which is this Taoist self-cultivation that we talked about. And then also instruction for women right here. Similarities in contents of all of these communities, just being very general, there's a preeminence of Confucian morality, there's salvationist ideas, there's Taoist self-cultivation, and some Buddhist elements. And in general, all of them somewhere in the texts have the rhetoric of the unity of the three religions, San Jiao Hui. So there's Confucius, Buddha, and Lao Tzu, who are all at the same level and all can instruct us. But in fact, the unity of the three religions, San Jiao Hui discourse, which we could also talk, we can also discuss as syncretism, is not really sufficient to describe what we have here. Some people, Professor Clark again, talks about the fusion of Taoist model and charitable society. Hu Jishen talks about the Confucian transformation and appropriation of a Taoist cult. Professor Lai Jatim talks about lay Taoist communities utilizing Confucian morality. Oles talks about Confucio-Taoist elements. Wan Jianchuan, the creation of Confucian religion. But all of these are ways, are insufficient ways or unclear ways of discussing this. And some people also use the word syncretism. But there is really no real equality between the three religions for the communities that produced these texts. Every community is different. So merchants' communities, local literati communities, local Taoist adepts, charitable group. So it's important to, first of all, understand the differences between communities. All of these communities that I really briefly talked about all have their own specificities and their own reasons for connecting with the divinities that they connect to and for asking for the text that they ask for. So here I wanted to really briefly talk a little bit about San Jiao Hui and then possible alternative readings, possible alternative ways of looking at this, which might or might not work. It's just a way for me to understand this better. First of all, let's mention a little bit the term San Jiao Hui, which is often used in the late imperial period, the unity of the three teachings. It does not allow for the complexity of the landscape and the reasons why we observe different traditions coming together. This description flattens our perspective as well as the meaning of a scripture or of a religious place. It makes it two-dimensional, it erases its complexity, and it does not take into account local history and how history has transformed it, the place or the text over time. When used as a self-described explanation, it's often used with the underlying assumption that one of the three teachings is in fact superior to the other two, which in turn provide validation for its preeminence. Joachim Gentz has discussed this in a recent article, saying that there is no evidence, either from historical sources or from empirical fieldwork, that a harmonious unity of the three traditions has ever existed in practice. It's merely a discourse which has no institutionalized reality as a counterpart. It is, So San Jiao Hui flattens the reality of what we see and what we read. Personally, I like the idea of localization. So really looking at each community and seeing what's going on in that community from the sources, from the steles, from the physical evidence. Also, what I have liked is the discussion that Rob Campany, who is a scholar of earlier religion, when he talks about Taoism and Buddhism, taking after Swidler, he talks about religions as repertoires of resources. And he says, religions contain untold number of aspects of or elements built up almost by almost infinitely many parties over time. Aspects that once available are invoked on different occasions for different purposes. And seeing religions as repertoires means seeing people as agents, making and doing things with reference to the many elements available to them in religious repertoires, rather than seeing religions as agents acting on people. So it's people as agents and not religions as agents. So this is the idea of religious as repertoires of resources, that people take different repertoires as they need them. Also, I like what Adam Yet Chow, who is an anthropologist, talks about, oops, let me see this last thing, modalities, different modalities of doing religion, rather moving away beyond the structure of Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism, and looking at the modalities of doing religion of Chinese people. And he also talks about efficacy, Ling. He focuses on Ling because he believes that Chinese popular religion is the concept of magical efficacy, has the concept of magical efficacy, Ling, which is conceived of as a particular deity miraculous response to the worshipper request for divine assistance. So communities, in my understanding, gravitate towards a specific god not because of a specific religious tradition that they're attached to, or because of the unity of the three teachings, but because of the efficacy of that god, the efficacy that is indicated to that community by, for example, state support, local support, etc. So I contend that spirit writing as a practice of a growing lay elite pushes against the three teaching idea, the Taoist, Buddhist, Confucian categories, by appealing directly to a divinity considered efficacious. This efficacy in both the cases of Wenchang and Luzu and others derives both from a process of universalization of these cults supported by the emperors, but also of localization, where local elites organize in individual communities, fundraise, build altars, produce scriptures. This concept of efficacy also works well because it can be explained differently for different localities. What is efficacious in one locality but might not be efficacious in another because of social political factors. And finally, agendas change over time, and my study of local temples devoted to Luzu and Sichuan details how different historical situations determine the community as well as the practices used at that particular site. In conclusion, I have a lot of conclusions. Just to give you, because I talked a lot and I brought up a lot of elements today, I wanted to sort of sum up a little bit and say Sichuan's religious landscape is rich and varied and mostly unstudied. Certain texts and traditions were imported from the coastal areas, but other texts were developed locally. Texts were shared between communities within the Sichuan, Yunnan, and Guizhou area. I didn't mention that in the when we were looking at a map, but it's not just Sichuan, it's other areas close to Sichuan that are part of this network. Post 1840, this whole area was influenced by a wave of eschatological discourse, violent anti-taxation rebellion. And the response was a wave of Confucianization that incorporated the eschatological discourse, but retained strong Taoist self-cultivation. We see activist-oriented values selectively drawn from the orthodox Confucian canon, encouraging social commitment, moral determination in the context of reconstruction after millenarian rebellion. And then, lastly, my idea of the concept of efficacy more fitting than the Sanjiao Hui rhetoric. So thanks very much.